quickest hypothermics we know. One was a half an hour. She got on the ski lift, rode it up. It was slow. It was just starting out in the morning. By the time she got to the top of the lift and started down, which was approximately 30 minutes, she fell over, you know, in uncontrollable shivers because she didn't have any food in her tank. There was poor physical conditioning. There was a lot of sitting on a cold chair. It was a windy day. And those type of things add up to hypothermia. Okay? This peak in the very center of the slide is the one they're trying to climb. It's called Banner Peak. It's a 13,000-foot peak, and it's in the Sierra Nevada. The one to the right is called Banner Peak, which is equivalent in height. And they're just making their approach in. It's a beautiful day. We do have some high clouds. We know that clouds beginning to accumulate is an indication of bad weather, but these are kind of scattered right now. Okay, this is their camp. So they're camped at about 6,000 to 8,000 feet. I'm unsure if that is the time. They're not too environmentally sound. You can see they have a fire on top of snow, which they don't know where the ashes and coals are going to end up at. Or it could be in a drier spot, but there's still snow on the ground. The outside temperature now at night is 20 degrees. Okay, so it's still a fairly cool area. And the reason it's 20 degrees is because of the altitude. We know as you gain elevation, you gain anywhere from 3 to 5 degrees for every 1,000, you lose temperature 3 to 5 degrees for every 1,000 feet you gain. So if they're at 8,000, it could be a lot warmer where they started in the parking lot. I'm trying to get it to go cooler. Okay, this shows them starting out on the climb. Now, these particular slides will start to get darker, and this is because of the copying process. The sky actually becomes really dark, and we know an angry sky is not one that we want to hang around with. But this is in the morning, they're starting out. Morning temperatures, you know, we're above freezing. Okay, good. This shows the peak. Notice the slide is getting darker. And if you really look closely, I don't know if the focus will bring that out, right on that cornice, right in the very center of the slide.
Back up one?
Yeah. Okay, just on the ridge you can see little bits of snow. I can't really see from back here, but believe me, they are there in the slide.
You just better go back.
With snow stirring like that, it's not snowing out. What does that indicate? High wind. What else does it indicate? Which way does the low pressure work? Does it lift winds or push them down? Okay, we'll talk about that under weather. That's a clue for you. They're heading towards the peak. Great. Okay, now we can see the clouds are getting darker. This person with his back to us is one of the individuals who, in this situation, they had a thing called rime ice. And what it is when water droplets are falling through the atmosphere, they're super cool, and unless they have some dust particle to contact, they don't turn into snow. And as they drop, they freeze everything they hit. And I'm sure you've seen a lot of it in the Midwest. You know what happens? It hits the road, it just leaves a sheet of ice. Okay? In order for snow to form, there's got to be some kind of dust particle in the air. And this is what they do when they seed clouds, is they add dust particles in the form of, silver iodine, that all of these super molecules are positively charged, they link up to it, and automatically they form snow. Okay, question?
Yeah, you know, it's getting darker. It looks at the beginning like that was just, you know, going up and there's less oxygen in the air, so it just gets darker and colder.
Yeah, but it should stay blue.
It was clouds?
No, this isn't clouds. It's just a darker sky coming about. And it's caused from clouds, but I'm not sure exactly what type. Blooded clouds, I guess you could say. Mm-hmm. But what's happening, and what happened to this gentleman here, is these rime droplets came down and they stick to everything. Mm-hmm. Except for your rain gear. They stuck to his eyelashes and eventually sealed his eyes closed. And he was afraid to scrape the ice out of his eyes because he didn't want to damage him. Okay, so now they have a person they're leading around during this climb.
You can't see, so there's slower process. The rye mites is building up, and I don't know if you've ever seen on someone's beard, but it gets to the point when I had a beard that it weighs you down. Because as soon as one droplet hits, the next one sticks, and it just keeps mounting up on you. Same thing happens to highways. It's an emergency on any runway. It's an emergency if aircraft run into it. Because rye mites will stick to the shell of the craft, because that's all it needs is a small particle, and there it goes. If it does contact a particle, it turns into snow. Okay, here we can really see the weather getting a little bit worse. This was the only survivor, Bill Avery, and it was said that he was in good physical shape. He had a lot of climbing experience. He did have wool clothing on. Okay, they took very few breaks during this particular session. You can see the weather is coming in a little bit different. Okay, this is a good indicator, you know, that probably you'd want to turn around, because we know lowering clouds that accumulate are an indicator of bad weather. Okay, there's a lot of weather indicators that we have available in the village here, but usually accumulating clouds at lower elevation aren't going to be good, especially for valley weather. Okay, this is one of the few breaks they did take. This is one of the few slides of them being alive. You can see they're bundled up now. They're putting on more clothing because it is getting colder. The higher they climb, they're breathing more, so their bodies are becoming chilled from the inside. And as they're moving along, we find out that, at least from Bill's testimony, that most of them would wait until they were really cold prior to putting clothes on, which tends to drain body heat. You want to be dressed warmly prior to feeling the cold. Okay, this is the last slide of them being alive. This is just prior to the guys running into the rime ice. They're climbing along. They found out the route was a lot more technically difficult than they expected. They had to use crampons. They only had one rope for five people. They had to belay people in short stretches. They had a lot of inexperienced people who were very nervous about the climb in general, but they pressed on. And this is a good example of determination. You know, whether they killed them or not, they were determined they were going to go for the peak. At this point, it could also indicate that they were mildly hypothermic and they were losing their orientation to the group. You know, that they were already so cold that they really didn't know why they were out there in the beginning, and it's just really easy to follow along. And so they got the use of a large muscle mass, but to be able to help themselves through using some type of strong logical reasoning is probably not possible. Okay, this shows the route that they were climbing up, so it's fairly steep. I don't know if I can get on there. It's up this area here, up this coulee. And the next slide shows you the top portion of the route where they came out. So as you can see, it's not a technically difficult peak. When they got on the ridge, it was probably close to 20 degrees, whiteout condition. The wind was blowing really hard. You know, so hard that it would push them to their knees. Okay, so they have a person who's blinded by rime ice. They have two other individuals in poor physical shape that eventually just plopped over and died. So Bill Avery cut everyone off the rope and set every person for themselves. He felt that was the only way they could survive. They started to dig snow caves in the area of the chute around in here, and then they just stopped for no apparent reason and say they didn't want to do that and start walking on again. And then they stopped and start building another snow cave. So that showed that they were pretty hypothermic. Looking down at a particular room, so you can see it's not a steep angle, but the angle is enough when you get a lot of energy to obtain it. We know that climbing slopes like this are going to burn about 16 calories per minute. So we know it doesn't take but very few hours before our breakfast and whatever's in our tank is expended. Okay, what happens is after we cut them loose on the rope, the two people who were already crawling on their knees and were incoherent and couldn't even speak slid down that particular chute that we were looking at. This is where one of them was found. The other one was found down far. You can see the rope were, you know, it's no longer a long climbing rope. There wasn't really much of a chance you could do for these people, because just prior to them sliding away, they were frothing up blood, so they had an inner core temperature that was really low. You know, because we know it's pulmonary edema, and this is where fluid is so cold in the lungs, the blood's passing through the tissue itself, and it's coming up in the form of frothing fluid. Okay, this shows the snow cave that they started and finished, but it was just a rock outcropping that they saw a little space behind it. And we know when we decide to build a snow shelter, we want to make sure we pick an area that's not windblown, because if you have the wind coming in your shelter, it's really not very effective at preventing anything. And you can kind of see the crampons and their feet sticking out here. One crampon was missing, and during the climb, the individual who was missing the crampon, when it was returned to him, said, "Is that my crampon?" He didn't even realize he had one off and one on. These are used in technical climbing. So he knew it, or should have known at that point, the person was hypothermic and extremely cold and should have done something about it. Okay, this kind of shows where the wind has blown in on him in this area over here. You can see how it's drifted in on him. Avery stated that they died sometimes during the night. He just pulled both bodies, that he was between them, which was probably a very good survival factor, but after they were dead, they just pulled the bodies in and he got on top of them and used them as insulation between the cold ground and himself. He was brought to court by the families of these particular climbers, and they tried to sue him for abandonment and a lot of other things, but all the charges were dropped because of the severity of the situation. It was just, like he said, it was every person for themselves. Okay, this shows the inadequate size of the snow cave, as well as the drifting snow in over the people. Okay, this is after the bodies were removed. This is just a mountain rescue person using up the film that was on this guy's camera. And you can see a lot of equipment that was in there that they tried to use for insulation, but what was surprising, they found a lot of food and a lot of water left over that they never did try to eat or drink, which could have possibly given them more calories and more energy that they would have been able to realize that they were getting into a bad situation. They didn't use any of their equipment that was outside. They could have brought in sections of rope. They could have used their day pass and things like that as insulation against the ground, but they didn't. So through direct conduction, they increased their body heat loss. These were two of the people that were inside this. Inside of the snow cave, and you can see the person's holding onto the rope where they cut loose. This isn't considered all that good a form to decide that it's every person themselves. That kind of went out in the old shipping days, you know, when they were attacked by pirates. But in modern mountaineering, you have to consider the entire group. It's called expedition behavior, and how you react to the group is very important. Individual to individual as well as individual to the group. And you have a very strong obligation to get everybody back in one piece, whether you're the leader or just a member of the group. And if a person isn't eating, if they're cold, if they're shivering, you don't say, well, that's their tough luck. You either correct it, you know, or you turn back. At least in modern mountaineering, that's been done. In this particular situation, I don't think, unless they would have acted a lot sooner than they realized the problems were happening, they could have saved anybody. And this is looking down the ridge. The ice axe is sticking in the snow there, kind of points to the snow cave. Okay, so we talked about the priorities last night. And I think if we look at some of our priorities as it related to that situation, and we looked at the body's enemies, we know hypothermia is a key one there because of a lack of shelter, a lack of insulation, a lack of water, a lack of food. All of these things are combined factors. We have someone who's acidotic because they haven't been breathing properly. We have an individual who's probably fatigued from shivering. We know that mild shivering is equivalent of jogging. We know that intense shivering is equivalent of chopping wood. So that individual is burning up a tremendous amount of energy. But when we think about the survival priorities as it related to this situation, they should have recognized early in the climb the weather factors and then gone ahead and either made shelter and prepared to spend the night or headed back down while they still had an opportunity to. This kind of shows some of the body's enemies as they relate to problems in any type of survival situation. We won't really hit on these that hard, you know, while I'm at holding, but we kind of mention some of them. A bad mental attitude obviously is a very poor thing to have, and it is a top body enemy. And some of you can realize that because you can bum yourself out just about how you feel about yourself and how you project about yourself. We know that self-image has always played a key role in people in being really content with what they have. I've seen it in situations of employment. When I went in to ask for a job, if I was really, I felt good about myself, I felt good about working for them, groom, I was tired, but if I didn't really care, that also showed. So it's got to be some type of an attraction that people have when they have a good mental attitude versus not. But in survival situations, a bad mental attitude, where you don't have a very good will to live, maybe you don't decide to keep an eye on your body problem indicators, can lead into to some more dangerous areas that we need to consider. Serious medical emergencies, these are the things we have very little control over. We tend to try to avoid them, such as the sprained ankle while we're 7 miles out on our cross-country skis, that fracture that we might run into, an accident, maybe one of the snow vehicles. We tend to try to avoid these things, but they happen. But we do realize that they're one of the top problems, and we'll talk about that when we cover frostbite. In nature's adverse potential, that's just a way of shortening a variety of things that happen, such as avalanche, floods, storms, a variety of things that, again, you have no control about, but you can learn about on your own and through some of the sessions. I think we'll cover avalanche in some of those areas really well. Under serious medical emergencies or nature's adverse potentials, we could put down frostbite and hypothermia, but that would be up to you whether or not it's a natural thing or something that's accidental in relationship to how you feel about staying alive in a winter community. Fatigue and exhaustion. These are really some key things, because when people are fatigued, they tend to make poor judgments. We know from reading articles on accidents in North American mountaineering that people who are fatigued on a descent create more problems than people who are ascending. That once you're tired, you generally make mistakes. This is true of skiing, cross country, or downhill. A lot of you know the standard rule in downhill skiing is that once you're tired, you hang the skis up for the day. It's because it's that point in time that you do things that are careless, and it's that point in time you respond incorrectly to a fall or to a situation. We know that perspiration and dehydration are really some bad enemies to us in a winter community, because we find out when we become dehydrated, we lose water volume in our blood. Our blood tends to not be circulated as readily. This is why people have froze their feet in major expeditions in their sleeping bags, because once you lose water through dehydration, whether it be a process of being too warm or perspiring too much, you'll find out your blood volumes decrease and you're going to be colder. And in most cases, unless you have a general body warmth, at that point in time, it's not going to be pumping blood to your extremities, such as your hands and feet. Okay, and in going without food, there's a strong correlation to cold and lack of food. There's no doubt about that. We can get by without it. You know, you're encouraged always to carry a day or two extra rations on any trip that you go on, just in case you get stormed in. I would recommend a minimum of a day. You know, in the day's ration, we might say 5,000 calories. So that if you do have a situation where you're going to be overdue, you won't have to worry about pushing on because you don't have any food, or you don't have enough fuel, or you don't have enough energy to make it back. Then there's other essentials that we'll hit during this course, such as the 13 essentials that Martin will cover later on, that are kind of key to helping us avoid survival situations as well as emergency situations.
Take their college students and immerse them in cold water and get them down to a low body core temperature and then pull them out and then have them shivering in warmth or huddle together, whatever. We're not allowed to research with humans in the United States by doing that. So our government's been paying Canada a lot of money to use their people to go out. But on that, there's been a lot of books and a lot of articles that have come out. And one of the key things about rewarming hypothermic, we know that someone has a cold temperature, that if they're in fairly good shape, if they're not too exhausted, they can rewarm, you know, from 94 degrees on up by themselves really easily. You just have to get them in a warm room or in a sleeping bag, and they'll shiver to rewarm. Okay, but we also know from their studies that if a person's tired or in poor physical condition, if they have an 84 temperature 94, and you put them in a quality sleeping bag, their temperature's still going to go down, and they need to be rewarmed externally. So we need to look at some major differences. if we had a situation here in Holdenburg, and you have had that hunter a couple years ago that came in, the guy was so cold, he just went to lie down somewhere. I guess he lay down in the lodge and just slept for like 12 hours, and when he got up, he was pooped. He was really exhausted because he'd shivered so hard bringing himself to rewarm. There's a case in Lake, Wisconsin. It was called The Coldest Man Alive, an article in Reader's Digest. A person from the natural resources area were going out to check buoys or something. Their boat flipped over. He was in the water so long, he shivered so hard that he had pulled muscles for 6 months afterwards. Okay. When they took him to the hospital, he was shivering so hard, they had to give him a shot of Karari, which is a paralyzing drug, to keep him from hurting everybody because he was flopping around so much. So shivering is a powerful force, but it also indicates to us that we have to be concerned with how we treat a hypothermic. The three people we warmed on Mount Rainier when I had a snowshoeing class up there, my students literally attacked them. They didn't have a chance. We'd already talked about hypothermia. They said, there's a hypothermic, and we're going to get them. And they ran out. These kids didn't know what hit them. You know, they said, you're hypothermic. No, we're not. We're from Wisconsin. And they were really shooken up. And I've rewarmed a lot of accidental hypothermics. I like to bring it out that the president of the Snowmobile Association, I'm not really fond of snowmobiles, his daughter was in one of my classes, and she took her snowmobile out there and dug a shelter underneath that uses a space blanket instead of ground insulation. I didn't catch it right away. She didn't use a foam pad or anything, just laid a space blanket, threw a sleeping bag on it, and by 4 in the morning when I was checking shelter, she was just incoherent. She was so cold. We drug her out, put her in front of a fire, and rewarmed her. And her dad was so embarrassed he left the field, because you know, he was the survival advisor to the Snowmobile Association. So it can happen to anyone. Okay, but in the times that we rewarm people, it's really important that you don't scare them to death, because they may not know what hypothermia is. A lot of studies in ski areas where people cross-country ski in Colorado, where they check people in and out of the areas, they've asked them, hey, you know what hypothermic is? And they go, you pervert, get away from me. But they really don't know what it is. They don't have any idea. So if you come up and tell them, hey, you're hypothermic, we're going to rewarm you, they don't know what you're talking about. The group of people that was up at Holden Cabin, I don't know if some of you on the staff now might have been up there at the time, and a group of people from Oklahoma that went up there and got really cold, the people from Oklahoma didn't know what they were talking about. They weren't about to take their wet clothes off in front of strangers. So the staff attacked them, you know, and really held them down to get them to rewarm. You know, they put them in their pre-warm sleeping bags. And that happened at 3 in the morning, and it took until 10 the next day for those people from Oklahoma finally to get warm enough where they could move around. And I don't know if you know where Lyman Cabin is from here, but it took them from 10 until dark to walk back from Lyman Cabin. They were so pooped when they came in here, they were just, you know, they couldn't even look up. They had to kind of lift their eye to look around. They were really exhausted. So in the treatment, you've got to recognize that they don't know what it is, so it's tender, loving care always, and that's true in most medical situations. You have to recognize that the person's calorie depleted and dehydrated. Okay, so rather than making super hot fluids for someone who's conscious, just make warm fluids, because they need a lot of it, copious fluids, a lot of fluids. Maybe put some sugar in it because their calories are down. Get them to eat something, you know, if they are conscious. And you can find out, ask them if their helicopters eat their young, or something like that. If they say, sure, I heard they do, you don't want to give them any fluids, because they might be kind of borderline on being semi-conscious. I made that mistake a couple times. I gave a person a really hot cup of coffee when I felt they were probably at a good stage of hypothermia, you know, but were still able to drink, and they just spit all over me. You know, it just came right back up. Their internal core is also extremely chilled, so if you gave them very hot fluids, you'd also be making a mistake, too. They just kind of sit right in the stomach. So fluids are important, but copious amounts of just warm fluids, and this is provided the person's conscious. Okay, some kind of calories. You always want to consider that your priority is to get their wet clothes off and get them out of the wind, get them into a drier environment. If you have to pitch a tent, if you have to get them inside of a building, any kind of shelter, get them out of the wind, get on warm clothing with them, and if their temperature seems to be really cold, like they've stopped shivering, their muscles are rigid, they're turning blue, don't worry about putting clothes back on. You're going to have to huddle with them. Because if you don't, they don't have enough body heat left to rewarm themselves. And if you let them in there with just one clothing line and one sleeping bag, they don't have any heat-producing capabilities. And if you took, you know, like a frozen salmon and put it in a quality bag, it won't swim upstream. It'll sit there frozen. they've got translation instead of airspace. You've got one fan. But any time, like if we had a large coffee cup, if we put cold fluids into it, it stays cold. If you put warm fluids, it stays warm. If you put someone in a sleeping bag and they're really cold, they're going to remain cold. That's how we evacuate hypothermics over long distances. Just put them in a down bag and they just stay right at that temperature. Or even get colder. Okay? So you might have to crawl in the bag with them. Bags that sit together. And it's really a tough thing. You know, I've had my students rewarm hypothermics, not my own, but other students, and we managed to find in the field in situations. And if you get in a sleeping bag with someone who's really cold, you're not a very good conductor. All of your blood vessels all of a sudden constrict. You know, you don't like to be next to a heat sink. They're pulling all your body heat away. You can't stay in there long before you're really shivered too. So you have to build a fire and alternate people that you're in with. There's a classic article that I meant to bring, but to mention my lecture notes didn't make it, which explains this young man in a climbing party, and they were in Phoenix, Arizona, of all places. They went up the mountain somewhere north of there, and it took them 4 or 5 days to finally get in. It dropped 6 feet of snow. This was in 68, 69. They were cold. He had a broken leg. He was in a sleeping bag. They went out for help. The young lady who stayed there to try to help him had an inadequate sleeping bag, and he explains what happened all the way up to the time that she was found dead. And all of the symptoms and everything indicate, you know, that hypothermia was setting in. And you were trying to talk to both, you know, people in the same bag, and she said, no, I've heard about things like that. She didn't want to deal with it. You have to break down those traditional barriers, because when you find someone who's hypothermic, you know right away that it's a medical emergency, and you've got to get them warm. And you find out even after you get them warm, you can't allow them to go back into a cold environment for a while, because they're still susceptible. They're really fatigued, they're exhausted, you need to tank them up with carbohydrates and get their systems going again. Okay. Another point, as far as rewarming, the difference between someone who is conscious and unconscious, which is needed to distinguish. There's no fluids given to a person who's semi-conscious or unconscious. You never want to do that. You always want to go for skin-to-skin contact, and you always want to be very careful with them, because they have so much cold blood in their system that if you jar them very hard, they're going to go into ventricular fibrillation, where the heart's just working like a pan of worms. Okay? You want to make sure that you're very careful with them. The Coast Guard's killed a lot of people off the coast. You know, and they're beginning to admit it. That's why they're putting a lot of money into research for hypothermia, because their standard procedure, when they pulled someone out of the water, was to treat them for drowning. So they kind of move them around and slap them around and try to get water out of their system. They didn't have any water in their system. They were dying of hypothermia. When they shook them, their heart was going into ventricular fibrillation. But you can do CPR all you want, but the heart won't spontaneously recover until they're warm. Okay? It's also because of the acidotic. There's a lot of chemical imbalance. So let me put it in a sequence that all of us can live with. First, you get the clothes off them. And if they're a fairly warm hypothermic one that talks to you, communicates, just really cold, put dry clothes on them and just give them some fluids and food. And they'll probably recover fairly quickly. If they're really cold and you've asked them questions, they seem to be semi-incoherent, they have a difficulty in speaking, you witness them, they're stumbling around, they're almost in a stupor, you're going to have to strip off the wet clothing, get them into a shelter, and get skin-to-skin contact with a good Samaritan that has good body heat. You might have to have someone go for help at that point, or someone get outside and build a fire, so the good Samaritans can re-warm and switch off, because their body heat's going to go pretty fast. Just be like hugging a used frozen salmon when a person's really cold. Okay? And then after that, if the person's unconscious, you want that tender loving care, reassurance, don't put them back into the environment so you know they're really warm. Because you'll find out they'll go back into hypothermic fairly rapidly. Okay? The key points here, though, we're talking about treatment, are also key points in prevention. If you take in a lot of fluids, if you're eating regularly, if you're in good physical condition, and that you train prior to your activity, which is usually always required in mountaineering activities or winter community. If you kind of condition for what you want to do, you shouldn't have any problem with body heat loss. And a lot of you are probably looking at it, you know, a doomsday prophet. I'm really very serious. We find out in the statistics in this state that most of our accidents in the backcountry are related to people who are hypothermic. We have cases of people walking off cliffs, of elk hunters falling into rivers, of hikers trying to cross foot bridges and fall in. And this is because they stumble around and they don't have any coordination, or all of a sudden their ears get a ring in and they lose their equilibrium. It doesn't happen that way. What's happening is they've been out in a cold environment, they're damp, wet, the wind's blowing on them, their temperature's starting to drop, so they're not quite in that area where they can run as far or jump as high as someone else with a normal temperature, and they're making some mistakes. Okay? And in many cases, a person with a severe hypothermic that's conscious, you know, one that's in there in the 90 degree range, will try to convince you that they're okay, and they do a really good job of it. You know, they just make a lot of sense, you know, that they're just kind of tired. You really have to be able to distinguish by recognizing the temperature. Because once a person reaches the 90 degree of the core temperature down here, they quit shivering. They're still coherent. As far as discussions, they can talk to you. They probably won't be able to speak very well, but the muscles will be rigid. So all you have to do is ask them to do some kind of thing like tie their shoe. Okay? And generally, someone at that 90 degrees range, it's not really shivering very hard. The muscles in their hands and places like their feet and feet, all the minor muscles, not the major muscle masses, won't work. Because they're so cold, the bloods refuse to be pumped to those extremities. You know, so you'll be able to tell pretty fast. Their hands will feel extremely cold. I'm sure some of you have cold hands year-round, but their particular hands will be very cold to the touch. Okay. Does anybody have any questions? Okay, one time.
Pardon? That wasn't necessarily a factor. I know my hands can move and become numb outside fairly easily without feeling a loss of warmth or shivering.
Well, I'm sure, no, that's just your valves or something like that. There's a lot of systems to improve that. You know, that people, people have cold feet, they wear, you know, long underwear almost all the time in the wintertime. Some of the people last year, I think, sewed themselves in that one pair of underwear. And that helps your feet considerably. I mean, you have to bend your underwear up more with your top. People who have cold hands sometimes will wear silk gloves, you know, inside of the mitten, and Martin will talk about that. Silk doesn't add that much heat to it, but it allows you that when you do pull your mitten off, you don't get direct contact with the surface. And then you can try biofeedback. You know, that's, and our university, we're doing a lot of that. I'm getting plugged in with sometime this winter, and I've seen some good results where they put little thermometers on the tips of your fingers, and you just sit there and think, and they tell you when the temperature of your hand rises. And they've used a lot in some rare diseases where people's blood pressure drops considerably, and their extremities get cold, they can concentrate and actually warm up their hand. And I'm hoping to be able to plug into that. I have really warm hands, but I want them to get to my feet. They're not too anxious about that. I don't know. Okay. One more point, it's not a technical one, but it's one we need to cover for the benefit of the people in the village. If we had the jacuzzi going, you know, as a source of rewarding hypothermics, you could set up your own little service. It would really be a bad thing to do. I'm not having chalk here. Looks like chalk, either it's a piece of popcorn. All right, here's a piece. If we had someone who was hypothermic and we went to rewarm them, we'll find out that skin-to-skin contact, there's a little controversy. You really don't want to get the arms warmed up that fast. You want the trunk to rewarm first. Because if you put someone, let's say, in a tub of hot water and their temperature is 90 degrees, their internal core temperature, which you could measure, you know, probably directly, because you'll find out if they're shivering hard, they'll just snap your thermometer. I got one similar from England. Cost me a lot of money. The guy that was really happy, the first hypothermic I came to his grandmother, put it in, she just bit it right in half and lost it. I thought it took a while to get another one. So you might consider a different combination of approach. Okay, at 90 degrees, this, we'll say that's what you register temperature. If you were to take that individual, we'll say it was Becky, drop them in a hot tub of water to rewarm them, you get a thing called afterdrop. Because the blood in the extremities is really cool at 90 degrees, it's actually shut off from the main flow between the heart and the lungs and the brain. So all of a sudden you drop them in hot water, the blood vessels dilate, and all this cold blood that's just kind of sitting around here in the extremities goes towards the heart and drops the temperature even more. And they find out this is a problem in mountain rescue. They get there, they get on the scene, they take that individual, they try to warm up as best as possible, and the person dies on them. And the reason is because when you're really cold, if you warm them up you know, by putting a lot of heat all over them, the extremities release all that blood and sends it back to the heart, which is called afterdraw. So they've done surveys on what's the best system to be running. They pointed out that a moisturized heated oxygen is a system that's very expensive and Mountain Rescue carries now, works really well. But since we can't do that, we find out a combination we can use for someone who's really cold is just go ahead and use skin-to-skin contact if you can. If you're in a hospital situation, you can take hot packs and put them in the armpits, you know, on the chest and in the crotch, because that area tends to be able to simulate heat more readily. There's no fat there to insulate against it. Okay? So skin-to-skin contact's good, but leaving the arm sticking out, okay? Heated pads will work really well. The tub doesn't. The afterdrop for a tub will look something like this, and then the person will start to rewarm. The afterdrop with heated oxygen, if they're at 90, goes down just a little bit, and then they rewarm rapidly. Okay, and we know that using skin-to-skin contact, the afterdrop goes down, it's not very far, but it takes a real long time to get the person back up. But it's a better system because initially you don't have to rewarm as far. Putting a person in a tub of hot water can really adversely affect them. They can send so much cold blood back to the heart just as these blood vessels dilate that it can drop their temperature to the point where the heart can't stand the cold. Question.
Yeah, when you have skin-to-skin contact, you should rub the person, should you?
Not if they're really cold, no. You don't want to shake them at all.
No, not necessarily just shaking them, but just... Because I know for frostbite, you don't want to rub the frostbitten area, because what happens is your cells freeze, and there's like little glass particles in it.
Right, ice particles as well, period. The problem, it isn't the same thing in hypothermia. Usually, hypothermia and frostbite aren't all that related. I mean, you have to be fairly cold to get frostbite. But generally, hypothermia, as we're explaining it now, happens in temperatures above freezing. But if it was related to a case of frostbite, you really would have a rewarming problem. And, you know, like if someone was hypothermic and frostbite at the same time, your priority would be to treat the frostbite. And that would mean putting their hands and feet into water, and we'll talk about 104 to 110 in that area, and then work on the hypothermia. Because if you take care of the hypothermia first, you'll find out that their hands will be warm at room temperature, and they won't be very good. You'll find out they'll lose them. But if you rewarm them in a rapid rewarming system from 104 to 110, they'll probably save those extremities. But that's really a double problem. It really is. That's like talking about cardiac arrest and at the same time there's an avalanche coming. It's a double problem. Really a tough one. So the afterdrop's a critical thing. Another point to remember about hypothermics in your rewarming process is the calories. And it's really important to work towards getting in calories, because once you rewarm someone at 90 and they start heading back up, okay, so now they're coherent, they can take in fluids, you want to give them calories because they're going to start shivering. And if they don't have anything in their tank to shiver away, you know, no more energy left, then they're going to go right back on down and they'll have an afterdrop go right back into their own system. So you've got to get calories into them somehow. And you've got to get fluids, because they're going to be dehydrated. And then the calorie depleted, dehydrated, chemically imbalanced. And in some cases you can help this, you know, just by using honey. We find out that honey, if you just put it inside of your mouth, is assimilated just by your nasal area. You don't really have to ingest it very far. Okay? Is there any questions on hypothermia? Prevention or recognition, treatment? Does anybody have anything to add? How many people have seen a good hypothermic or been one yourself?
Okay, a couple of people.
We haven't been good. One that you actually had to notice, you know, and reborn.
What are the after results for someone who's been excessively hypothermic? Is there brain damage?
Generally not, no. It's kind of amazing that the brain just requires that blood to come up there and it'll take it cold. In the case of this person in the automobile for 4 hours, you know, immersed in water and was hypothermic, supposedly there was no brain damage. So that's kind of an interesting thing. There hasn't been a lot of research there. The Canadians will get them cold, but they won't get them that cold. And they put the thermometer in their ear so it stays out of the water, and they'll get them down to 94 before they pull them out. And they've done it over 1,000 times with different college students. College students get so many quality points towards graduation, whatever. I felt it was, I appreciate they're doing it, but I don't think I could pull that off at our university, regardless of what we offer them. Sure, because this group they put out in Puget Sound, you know the survival time in Puget Sound is only about 20 to 30 minutes with that water temperature before you pass out from hypothermia, that's called immersion hypothermia.
What's that word?
Pardon?
What is the word?
51. It varies from 49 to 51 degrees. You'll find out that we're really vulnerable to water temperature because that really pulls your body to the aware of that Lake Chelan. If your boat was to sink out in the middle of the lake, what would you do? Just in theory, would you try to swim to shore?
No.
Why not?
Because
you lose
too much energy.
Right, you lose a lot of heat. Use what they call a HELP, which is heat escape lessening posture, where you just bundle up and you try to get as small a ball as possible. Because as you swim, you tend to immerse your body in cold water, and it pulls away your body faster than trying to stay there in one position. Your survival time is a lot longer, unless you're within a short distance of the shore. And if you're a good swimmer a short distance of shore, you'll find out you could go for it. But in rafting in cold rivers, when you get dumped, I've seen students that turn into this, they look like a beached whale because they can't, they have no more mobility. They have to roll out of the water to get out. Any questions?
Yeah, I mean, it's called survival slope. Same thing, you know, you bundle up and you really take a breath now and then. But could you swim and then stop and rest and swim and stop?
No, it wouldn't work. Actually, that survival float isn't really what you want to do either, because that requires you to put your head in the water.
Yeah.
And if you, as soon as you get your head in the water, you really, you've defeated the process.
What's
it's getting like this.
How do you keep it in the water? You've got to like this.
Well, usually you would have a life vest, I'm sure.
If you don't,
I would say good luck. Pardon?
You could be with your boat.
Yeah, you could stay with your boat. So we are in front of the avalanche giving CPR again. Question.
If you're in the water and don't have a life vest or a boat to hang on to, it is best to have your head in the water because outside, above the water, your head weighs 16 pounds. It's like trying to hold a bowling ball above the water.
I'm assuming you have flotation of some sort.
How long do you stay in that position?
Not very long. Yeah, but if you try to swim ashore, you wouldn't last very long at all. We can try this out. We're always looking for volunteers.
I was going to say about you can test that out in the sauna plunge, because I know that I can, if I stay really still, I can sit in the sauna plunge for maybe a minute or two, but the minute I start moving around, I feel really cold. But I think my body heat just puts a little insulating layer of water. It warms up the water right around my body. And once, once you start flailing around in there, then you feel really cold automatically again. But if you sit really still, you can stay in there a little.
We can compare it that if we were outside and we were wet without wind, okay, that's the effect of just sitting there still. But as soon as you start to move in the water, it's the equivalent of being wet outside with the wind, so it pulls away body heat rapidly. Mm-hmm. And some of you can try it. We're going to fire up the sauna tonight, so we'll be able to get you re-warm. But just go in a cold plunge, you know, after you're really hot, and keep your head out. And the next time, try it, put your head under. See what happens.
Yeah.
I've seen a lot of backpackers that, you know, they have to get their hair clean. We're on a 10-day trip, and they can't stand it. There's ice floating in the water. As soon as they stick their head in the water to get their hair wet, they get these headaches, and their hair just big goosebumps. So your head is really vulnerable. It's like a radiator of a car. And if you chill it down, the rest of your body goes pretty fast. That's why it's important to select good headgear when we're talking about a winter community, especially with the type of snowfall where it goes from light snow to wet snow in this area. Because if you have a good wool ski cap, you'll find out you're going to be a lot better off than trying to make it with a lightweight baseball cap or any other type of garment. Okay. Why don't we go ahead and take a 15-minute, is it usually a break at this time?
Mm-hmm.
15 minutes?
The lecture on frostbite has just begun.
And if we had a situation where, let's say we had Barb out, she's skiing around, she's got her pack on, she's out on an overnight, she's got her MSR stove or some powerful winter stove, she pulls out her fuel bottle, the worst form of frostbite that we could contact is holiness called flash frostbite. And the way she would actually freeze the tissue in her hands would be if she opens her fuel bottle, she's wearing a mitten, but she can't quite get the cap, so she pulls the mitten off, and she's filling the stove, and water, or excuse me, the fuel comes out and spills over her hands. At that point, we know gasoline doesn't freeze until 70 below. So it's really rare that you're going to find gas freezing up here. We also know that it maintains the temperature whatever it reached overnight. It doesn't rewarm rapidly because it's a volatile fuel. And we also know, because of evaporation, that not only is it super cool, but it evaporates rapidly, it's going to be like a freeze-dried dinner. That's how they cook a dinner, put it in a little tray, and then they super cool it really rapidly. And that's why TV dinner always looks like it, whatever. So she's actually freeze-drying her hand. It's the worst form of frostbite because at that point in time, we've also introduced the lead from the fuel into her system, which generally is associated with gangrene, either a wet or dry form of gangrene. So that's one form of frostbite. And the reason it's devastating is because in most frostbites, not in hers, we find out that when you have cells, they look like little eggs, okay, and they have a nucleus to them. And a normal healthy cell will be stacked up like that, but as soon as you start to get cold and your tissue starts to freeze, we'll say through direct contact, which we'll talk about in a little while, these cells become dehydrated, and between the cells, ice crystals start to form. And this is where someone was, you know, graciously pointed out that that's why you don't rub a severe frostbite case, because if you rub it, like they used to say, you'll find out that those cells become destroyed because they're very vulnerable. They're chemically imbalanced and they have all these sharp edges between them. But in the case of Barbara's frostbite, where she spilled fuel, it freezes so rapidly, the cells freeze themselves. And they're dead. So you're going to have massive tissue loss, regardless of how you rewarm it, whether you rewarm it in the rapid rewarming system that I talked about, or rewarm it with snow, you're going to lose a lot of tissue. So that's why super cool fuels, and I'll show you a set of legs where a guy poured some glycol down his boots. You know, it just super cooled his feet at that point in time. Lost him. There wasn't anything they could do. So those people that work in the garage or around radiators where you have antifreeze, or when you're working with your backpacking stoves, you really have to make a conscious effort not to spill any fuel. To show you how drastic it is, I had a student on 49 degrees north, which is a ski area, and I watched him do it. He was filling up his fuel bottle. He was really careful. And you know how sometimes the fuel will shoot out the top just to drop? One drop landed on his thumb. Just one drop of fuel. And by the time the trip was over, it was green and moldy in that one little spot where it hit. Just one drop, so it's pretty serious.
Is there nothing you can do to wash it off? Or
no, it happens that fast. Even if you had water there, you know, running, I doubt if you could do it fast enough. It's just like that. As soon as it hits, it freezes. Okay? And we discussed that one because I've seen a lot of times where people leave their fuel bottles out in the snow around here, so they don't bring them inside the building. I noticed that last time I was here. That fuel gets super cool. You know, so then if you do open it to fill your stove, lean around these buildings, as long as the temperature is below 20 degrees, you have a very good chance of contacting frostbite. But as I mentioned, which is the worst type, and I'll show you slides of the situation and what it looks like. Okay? But generally it happens through prolonged exposure to the cold. You're going out on a trip, you have inadequate general body warmth, maybe you've been drinking leads towards frostbite because you feel warm, but it dilates your blood vessels. Okay? Probably the worst thing you can do. Drinking associated with frostbite in Alaska is probably the highest cause, or one of the top causes of frostbite with most of the people up there. They get tuned in, they get in their car, and they're driving home, and they realize they left part of their skin on the door handle. Okay? So when you're tuned in, you find out your blood vessels dilate and allows heat to escape at a rapid rate. Your palms get a little sweaty, so when you touch metal, you stick to it, as well as your general body heat goes down, although you feel warm all the way up until the time you die. So it's also a contributing factor and accidental hypothermia. People who smoke, as long as you condition as you smoke, you're okay. But if you smoke and you're not an active person, we find out that the parts per million, you know, your oxygen goes down. So physiologically, you're 1,000 feet higher in the mountains than we are when you smoke. So smoking in that particular respect does contribute to frostbite. Some of you who are not conditioned to smoke will be 10 to 15,000 feet higher than us around here who do not smoke. Okay, so smoking can contribute. Accidents in prolonged exposure contribute to it. We talked about it on this break with some of you. If you get in an accident, if you cut yourself, if it's an automobile wreck, any chance of really crashing and burning, you're under a lot of stress, the blood tends to pool in larger muscle masses, and you can get frostbite really easy, and I'll show you some slides of that. Okay? So accidents are related to it. But prolonged exposure to the cold means temperatures below freezing, generally 20 degrees for an hour, will give you frostbite if you're improperly dressed and if you're exposed to the environment. That's kind of a general rule that mountaineers use. But if there's a wind chill factor, you've got your wind charts, it may not even take an hour. Martin, one time when he was in the South Pole, his boss decided to paint the boat, you know, 50 below outside, and he decided he wanted to paint. The paint wouldn't even stick, but he had to give him something to do, and he had a headset on which allowed the wind to blow by his ear, so he had a little frostbite on his ear. For people who operate ski resorts, and even skiers, that's probably the most common form of frostbite. You wear your stocking cap for lifts, you wear it up here, and you get these big gloves on your ear when you're free. And generally it's because of the wind. So wind's a contributing factor to frostbite. Okay? And then my pet peeve is the fatigue and exhaustion thing. If you're really pooped, you've been working hard shifts here, and it's your day off, and you're going to go skiing no matter what, you're making a big mistake. You really are. I see it all the time in the academic setting. Students are cramming for tests, late hours, maybe they've got a girlfriend or a boyfriend is giving them a hard time. They're not getting a lot of sleep, and they try to go to the field, and you just don't, and you can't cut it on a Hostess Twinkie diet. There's just no way. You become exhausted and fatigued really easy. You're very susceptible to hypothermia and extremely susceptible to frostbite. They don't go hand in hand. You can get frostbite really easy compared to hypothermia. Hypothermia, you have to kind of work at it. Okay? A little bit. So, system so far I mentioned was prolonged exposure to the cold, which tends to do it with inadequate clothing. Okay, and then the second one is flash frostbite that I already mentioned. The third is direct contact frostbite. And what happens when you touch a cold surface, usually you're wearing a mitten or your hands in your pocket, and you go to do something, maybe you touch something metal, it's outside, it's been sitting out all overnight. It's an excellent conductor, and it conducts your body heat away so rapidly that if you have your hand in your pocket, it's a little bit moister. If it's extremely cold, your hand doesn't have to be moist, and you stick to it. A good friend of mine who advised a lot of the Alaska pipeline workers on what to wear, I told him to mislead him, but he didn't. And as far as clothing, he was up there, and he knew with his heavy mittens on, he couldn't get the door open to this tracked vehicle that they were going to drive around, and he knew not to do it. He pulled his hands out and reached up, and he was a short guy. So here he's reaching up, holding on the steer wheel, and he froze to it. You know, it's really embarrassing. And he, said he couldn't get up to it, you know, because he couldn't do a one-arm pull-up. There wasn't anything else to grab. And he just kind of stood there, and he knew right away when they came outside the building he had a problem. You know, he was screaming and yelling. And it's just kind of standard. People up there just have a little bit of warm water somewhere, and they put it on his hand and pull it off. And he went inside, and he lost a lot of skin layers. But that's minor frostbite. But if he would have kept in contact with that cold surface, or people holding on the metal ski poles without a glove are squeezing too hard as a type of direct contact on something cool, even though you're insulated, you cut down the blood supply so it doesn't take a lot of cold. The capillaries in your hand have this tremendous survival mechanism. We'll say this is Jeannie's hand here. Sorry, I don't let any secrets out. If she touches something in this area, the capillaries will reroute the blood, okay, so this tip of your finger gets really cold, and as the cold gets in farther, the blood's rerouted farther, even more, so there's no blood in this area here, and as she stays in contact with the surface, it gets colder and colder, the capillaries keep rerouting to this point here, and they can't reroute any farther than that. Called capillary shunt. They'll shut off blood to a cold area. It happens the same thing when you sit on a cold surface. It's not because everybody has cold buns. When you sit on a cold surface,
the blood is routed to away from it because that saves precious body heat, your survival mechanism. The same thing happens if you have uninsulated boots, like you try to go outside and pair of waffle stoppers for a long period of time. You direct contact with the snow. The reason your feet get super cold is because the capillaries shut off the flow of blood to it. They don't want to be cold. They don't want to let all this body heat get away. Okay? And capillary shunt is a major reason why people have problems with their feet, because we know in a winter community the ground's always cold. Usually, whether there's snow on it or not, and when there's snow on the ground, we can take a thermometer outside, hang it in a tree, it might say 40 above in some cases, but if you drop that in the snow, it might be 10 degrees in the snow. The reason for that is cold air settles, and the snow tends to hold the cold air. It would be a great project for the science class this winter to measure the temperature, outside air temperature, 4 or 5 feet off the ground, and then measure the ground level, and you'll find out sometimes a difference of 40 degrees. So although your body's being bathed in 30 degree temperatures, your feet are standing in 10 degree cold. So while they're standing in that cold, there's capillary shunt. Cold air is attacking the feet itself, the capillaries are restricting, and it goes all the way up to this pineal arch area here. So in most cases of frostbite, you only have any more than just your toes, which is kind of nice to know, and I'll explain that later. Okay. So the three systems are direct contact, which causes that capillary shunt, or it could be that instant freeze direct contact of having a moist hand on a cold piece of metal conducts the body heat away. The prolonged exposure to a cold, usually with inadequate body dress, okay, and then the area of flash frostbite, which we know is really severe and is very debilitating. Okay, things to remember about frostbite is it's preventable. You know, so when you consider your winter dress, it's loose clothing, so there's no constriction. You know, for example, there was a rhino that was locked in a boxcar. And this guy was shipped down to Portland in a freezer car. He didn't realize it was a freezer. He got in it. They closed the door. He was in it. It was minus 23 degrees for 23 hours. That's pretty easy to remember. The guy made it through okay. He'd been drinking wine, so he had plenty of calories. Okay, and he just said, well, I'm just going to lace my boots down. He had insulated boots on that probably would have prevented him from getting frostbite, but he laced them down so hard that he cut the circulation off. We know that, for example, that a little nylon string jacket or a nylon jacket that has elastic cuff in it will reduce your circulation by between 1 and 5% to your hands, which is significant because it's already being reduced because of the cold environment. We know, for example, that those stretch support hose that people wear, the real tight ones, will reduce your circulation, peripheral circulation, up to 5%, which is very significant. Anytime you put on a constricting layer, either through elastic bands or some type of system where you're packing yourself into a tight pair of pants, you're going to reduce the actual value of that clothing because it's going to constrict the blood flow. And that is a predisposing factor to frostbite. Other things that come out that we can think of all the time as frostbite starts to develop is you have to remember that your body's trying to conserve heat. Okay, so if your feet are really cold, it's trying to cut down on the amount of cold blood that's flowing down to your surface. So if you put your hat on, you're going to be able to help your general body warmth. If you put heavier clothes on, you're going to be able to help general body warmth. If you stay active, moving your feet around, you're going to be able to promote general body warmth. But if you're not moving around, and all of a sudden your feet were really cold, and all of a sudden they feel really warm, you better check them. If you've been hiking, moving throughout, skiing all, and really active, then you stop, and your feet feel warm, that's fine. They probably are warm, you know, because skiing all builds a lot of heat. But if you're sitting in one spot, where you're talking to someone, you're out winter camping, maybe you're cooking dinner, and your feet were really cold just a little while prior to that, and all of a sudden they feel pleasantly warm, you're probably getting frostbite. Because one of the initial signs of your feet beginning to freeze is the fact it's this intense cold, and all of a sudden you get this warm, numbing sensation. And that's the initial stage that the freezing's having taking place. Happens a lot to duck hunters. They sit down there, their feet are in a hole, so they're automatic, they're in a cold air sump, because cold air settles, and they're sitting there enjoying everything, and all of a sudden their feet warm up, and they figure their $20 J.C. Penney boots are really doing their job. Well, it's not really true. Because of the inactivity, and it's hard for the blood to be pumped back to the system, the feet are actually beginning to freeze. Okay, as feet freeze, they're really easy to detect, because all you have to do is pull your boot off and take a look at them. Other parts of your body are also easy, like your face turns white, from the wind blowing on it, tip of your nose, your ears, your fingers, it turns white, hard, and waxy looking. And we know that's the initial stages. And if it's rewarmed at that point by putting your hand over it, putting your hand over your nose, rewarm that, using your hand just to rewarm your face, there's generally not too many problems. But if it's allowed to continue on, it becomes white, waxy looking, it becomes quite hard. Okay? Or doughy. Feels like dough just before you're ready to put it into the baking pan. If it's at that stage, it's generally advisable, depending upon where you're at, and I'm trying to give you a rule, to rewarm it in water. I'm sure a lot of you worked in your yard before, and you come in the house, your hands are really cold, so you walk over to the sink, turn the hot water on, you know how painful that is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When you rewarm that particular system up, that was just frost nip, probably no damage. But frostbite itself is going to leave some type of a damaging situation. So what do we want to do if it's really bad? Again, I'll give you some guidelines on that. Is you want to rewarm it in a large vessel. For example, if it's your feet, you've been hiking around, possibly you do get this sprained ankle, so that means you have a lot of blood going to that particular ankle. It's bruised, it's damaged, something's torn. You come back here, you pipe back in, and you find out you've been in your lightweight cross-country ski boots that are just one step above the bowling shoe, and you move into the village itself, there's no insulation, your feet feel really cold, you check them, they're hard, white, waxy-looking, generally the toes, they won't bend. When I had frostbite on my hands, I felt like I could run them through a tree, because I couldn't get them to bend. I concentrated, tried to bend them, they wouldn't go. So you need a large vessel that you can fill with water from 104, and then this is a controversial figure, to 110. We know you don't want to go much over 110 because you tend to warm them too rapidly and they get too flush and there's too much blood in that area. The reason you need to warm them in water is because we know water will always kind of sink its own temperature. But if you start to warm water up, the bottom of the pan isn't 80 and the top 60. It's always going to be the same temp. Okay? If you warm your hand in front of a fire, depending on how you turn your hand, you're going to get a different temperature. So if you keep it consistent, 104 to 110, rapidly warming, putting it in the water, the hand rewarms at the same time. So this means the blood vessels, which have impaired circulation, they've got this capillary shunt, and the cells can absorb water at the same rate the ice crystal melts. If, in fact, you warm in front of a fire, the ice crystals will melt faster than the cells are allowed to rewarm, and they're going to be extremely dehydrated, okay? And you're going to find out there's some real problems. There'll be loose fluid between the cells, yet the cells aren't thawed out yet, and you're probably going to lose some tissue.
How warm is 104 to 110 to the finger?
Well, I can tell you on my elbow, but if you had frostbite in your fingers, you wouldn't be able to tell. It's warm. It's above body temperature.
But it shouldn't feel hot.
Pardon?
It shouldn't feel hot.
Shouldn't feel too hot, no.
Just
overly warm?
Well, 104 is what the jacuzzi usually runs at.
Yeah, that's
kind of
warm.
Well, yeah, it is, but you know, like most hot water tanks, if you turn them up all the way, are usually 145, and that's scalding. It's pretty hot, okay? 104, you know, you're at 98.6. 104 isn't that much above you.
Right.
You should be able to tell. When it goes on, it's going to feel warm. You know, it's above lukewarm, though. Lukewarm would probably be 100.
But it wouldn't feel hot.
If the frostbite, it will.
Yeah, it's the frostbite, but not to normal skin, it wouldn't.
You'd feel warm, it wouldn't feel hot.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to go over it. And, it's a good idea to have one of those water thermometers around, because that's the best way to tell. And if you're going to be warm, you're not going to do it in a field situation anyways. You're going to want to wait till you get back to the village. Okay? And that way you're in a controlled environment, because there's some real phenomenal things that happen, at least in the research, that people who have frostbite of the right foot generally also have frostbite of the left foot. It's not a matter where one foot has and one doesn't, unless of course you plunged into a stream and one was wet and one wasn't. Because we know that moisture in your socks and perspiring tends to increase the rate of frostbite. This is why the Canadian government kind of issues a sure or air it extra dry, and they spray their feet with an antiperspirant so the feet won't sweat. And I tried that in Canada this last climbing trip. I just sprayed one foot and I left the other one right here. It does help. The only problem was I dried my feet out too bad. It really does dry your feet out. So I've got some problems with them now with being too dry. Most of the time...
Still okay?
Pardon?
Still hurts your feet? Now? That you did that one?
Well, you have to stack it. You have to put it on for like 5 days prior to the trip. You have to really get a good coat. All it does is plug up your pores.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. That's all antiperspirant does. I hate to disappoint anyone. Just plugs up pores. And that's what it did to my feet, and they didn't get a chance to get any moisture, so they're really dry right now. Super dry. And it's been taking me a while to get them back into shape. Becky's already had to deal with them, so she's a good reference. The point, I'm kind of getting off the thing, 104 to 110 is the water temperature. You want to make sure, like, there was a rewarding situation on Mount Spokane, and it was really tragic when the people were all mountain rescue people. This is a ski area less than 20 miles from Spokane, which has a pretty good population. They put this guy's feet in there, but the problem was they didn't suspend him. They let him set all the way against the bottom of the pan. So everything rewarmed beautifully. Got real flush except for the bottom of his foot, which he lost all the skin off the bottom of his foot because it didn't rewarm at a normal rate. So it has to be away from the bottom of the pan, and you want to try to work on keeping that water close to 104 to 110, because if a person puts in a foot that's really cold, they're going to drop the temperature of that water rapidly. So you might have to add a little bit extra hot water. A whirlpool would probably be the ideal way, since that tends to keep a standard temperature. So what are the consequences? We're out skiing, and usually it's going to come about from inadequate rest, poor condition, fatigue, possibly wind, and we notice our feet are really cold. Okay, we could then pull our boots off at that time and say, have our partner lift their parka and slip your feet on their stomach. And that's a time-honored tradition. Mm-hmm. I've had a lot of feet in my armpits. The only thing you want to remember, if you're going to go out skiing with someone, if you've got a size 9 armpit, don't ski with someone who's a size 12 foot. But that standard, you know, procedure is to rewarm someone's feet on your chest, stomach, or in your armpit. Okay, we'll say your feet aren't going to rewarm. They're really cold. They're hard, white, wax-looking, but they're not resilient. As you press on them, there's no give at all. The toes are just like pebbles. You have probably deep frostbite. And it should be rewarmed in water from 104 to 110. You can, at that point, just leave them frozen. Okay, and this sounds kind of grim, and then ski back to the village with them, or get the person back to the village. It's probably easier to stump out on them at that point than it is to chance rewarming, because once you rewarm someone's feet who has frostbite, they're a litter case now. Because you can't allow it to refreeze, because it'll be the worst frostbite you've ever seen. Their toes, if they are frozen, once they're rewarmed and refrozen again, will fall off in about 4 days. There'll be no doubt about it. The movie I used to bring here was kind of gross, but it showed that time lapse feeding remembers it. Most severe form of frostbite is when you freeze them, let them refreeze, and thaw them out and let them refreeze is really bad. I'm not trying to scare anybody, but we've got to be kind of sincere here that if you are going to do winter camping, you've got to be able to protect yourself, and you have to understand the objective dangers. Okay, if it's minor frostbite, where it is hard, white, waxy looking, it's resilient, it's kind of doughy, you can rewarm it in the field, but what happens, it's just like a burn, it's going to get a lot of swelling. So if it's your hands or your ears, something like that, you can rewarm the extremity by using someone else's body heat. And you'll see occasionally people have their head up under someone's parka, and they're just putting their ear against their stomach, which tends to be a good generator of heat. Okay? And that's one way to do it.
But see, you wouldn't want to do that with feet then, if you had to put them back into your shoes.
They won't fit. Mm-hmm. There's no way. They really get big. Mm-hmm. They look like someone blew them up with a bicycle pump. Mm-hmm. You would never be able to get them back in. Mm-hmm. Okay? But you could if you felt, you know, like it was a super bad case of frostbite, come back in on it. There's been trappers that have walked on it for 4 days in Alaska, you know, frozen solid, dumped their way out, and rewarmed it in this rapid rewarming and lost no tissue. Okay. In the same case, there's been people who contacted frostbite, and I'll show you a quick slide. A guy was wearing shoes, his automobile wrecked, and he had frostbite in just a little bit of time. Even in rapid rewarming, he lost a lot because there wasn't any blood from the shock in that particular area. There's been cases of people in automobile accidents with frostbite, and they rewarm in the ambulance on their way in, which has turned out to be the worst way to rewarm also. Because they're in shock, there's not very good blood supply, the extremity's frozen, and it rewarms at room temperature. So there's a variety of possibilities, but if you are out in the backcountry, the rule we've been using recently is leave it frozen, bring it back in and rewarm when you have good medical facilities, because it's best treated in a hospital condition. Because if you get it infected by rewarming it, it's just like a burn, highly susceptible to infection, and you get it infected, generally the type of infection that comes about is that dry or wet type of gangrene, which we know is going to create a problem for amputation. I think to get a track of where we're at, we should probably look at some slides of frostbite.
And when we're talking about cold injury, specifically when you're talking about frostbite, we'll talk about emergency and snow blindness and other related cold injuries, not related specifically to cold, but related to that type of environment later on. Okay, so 80% of the problem is going to be dealing with the feet. After that 80%, the next highest area is going to be on the hands, and then we talk about the fleshy parts of the body, the ears, the nose, the cheeks. And there's some real good articles, you know, by Stephens in the Arctic Explorer, went to visit some people, and as he was hiking to their house, he happened to touch his gun. So the gun was over there, and when he got to the house, his hand was stuck to the action of his gun, and they just brought it inside. The Eskimos don't use rapid rewarming, they use delayed thawing techniques, so they shove his hand in ice water, which created the freeze even more. This system is to thaw it out slowly. You know, it's more based upon superstition than any kind of fact. And people that have done that in the past, you've probably heard of people rubbing snow. You know, this has been really recent. People still do it in the Midwest. They rub snow on it to let it thaw out slowly. That's like putting a bird in a fire to treat it. You really don't want to do that. You want the rapid thawing process, not the slow. And this is a point to remember, especially in backcountry travel. Ideally, it's best treated in a hospital situation. Okay, this is a slide that kind of summarizes the cells that I attempted to draw on the board. On the top part of the slide, you see the normal cells and you see the ice crystals form. This is why it's important you never rub frostbite. It's also very important that you never give alcohol and try to rewarm someone on a frostbite situation, because the blood vessels themselves, and the reason we tend to lose a lot of tissue is because of these ice crystals that even form in the blood vessels. And if you give them alcohol, it'll dilate them prematurely, and you get a lot of these cells trying to rehydrate when the ice crystal's still there, and that's fatal to the blood. There's no room for it, yeah, to expand. They're chemically imbalanced also, so the rapid rewarming tends to allow them to absorb the water at a slow rate, which is equal to the ice crystal melting. Mm-hmm. And the bottom part shows the capillary shunt, and I would recommend that everybody just try that today. Find a piece of metal and put your index finger on it. Don't worry about frostbite. See what happens after a little while. You know, maybe just find someone who's got an old pair of gloves and cut one of the fingers off, and you'll see that the cold will continue to creep up your hand. And it's not something that's magical. Cold is the absence of heat. All it's doing is, because you're touching that cold surface, it's pulling away the heat out of that particular finger. You know, cold really doesn't exist. Okay? So this capillary shunt is kind of obvious. Whenever you sit on a cold wall and you get up and say, oh, my buns are cold, it isn't because the heat was extracted, because the blood vessels constricted and didn't allow heat to flow to the area, and then the heat was lost. This is a very, very minor case of superficial frostbite. You can see the tips of the fingers are white. This is after they've been rewarmed. This is the case of a person going out in adequate type of mittens, and we find out there's a lot of, inadequate types of mittens because he was wearing gloves. Generally, gloves are ineffective in winter communities as far as the source of heat, and Martin will hit on that when we talk about clothing. And this is a situation of a knife cut. You can see on the hand to the left, you know, on the right of the screen, where the individual cut himself, and as soon as he cut himself, it was kind of a shocking situation. Some people are pain tolerant, some aren't. People with a low pain threshold need to be very safe in a winter community, because if you do cut yourself and you have a mild form of shock, the blood, you know, goes to the larger muscle mass, it doesn't mean the hand shit in you, and you find out frostbite within a short amount of time after that. And this is, you could probably figure out if you look at the pattern of the frostbite on the lower parts of the fingers. Notice how this part over here is pushed to that sign. Mm-hmm. He had a tight rubber glove or rubber mitten on, the type used for mixing cement, and it actually constricted his fingers and pushed him in that direction. So while they were working, rather than have loose clothing that allowed good circulation, the tight fitting glove pushed the fingers over to, like, to a point almost, and created that frostbite problem.
Mm-hmm.
He was left. Lebs are just large blisters, but they're very good prognostic signs. If after rewarming, you're going to have a burgundy color extremity, it's going to be burgundy in color, and all of a sudden these large blebs will form, which means that new tissue is going to be regenerated underneath them. I'll show you a situation where there's no blebs, and you can find out that tissue destruction is evident. The same thing as what Burns says. You have tissue itself that's destroyed or damaged. Okay, like a blister that you get from wearing too tight a hiking boot. Okay, so you have fluid migrating to that area because it's similar to a heat problem, and the blood flows with fluid to protect the new tissue that's growing underneath. Mm-hmm. It's just basically a protection system. So new tissue, after these blood shut off, will be formed underneath. Those finger tips I mentioned I got in the mail, the person I saw after that had normal fingers later on, but those were the crusted webs that were left afterwards. That particular person really didn't go to the hospital and probably should have, because they now with whirlpool treatment, they can put you in a sterile antiseptic whirlpool and it sheds the skin off as it readily comes off and the infection is minimized and you don't get hard, crusty blood. Mm-hmm. This is the case of fuel. You can see there's no blood, possibly distally. You have a situation where it looks moldy and ugly looking, and that's just basically what it is. A lot of fuel, a lot of infection, very poor prognostic sign. This is a form of flash frostbite from your super cool fuel. Okay. This is an ear. This is kind of a unique slide. This is prior to being rewarmed. The tip of the ear is still frozen. And I have a couple of slides like that at one time. But this particular person was just out on a windy day. It really wasn't that cold out, but the wind chill equivalent made it fairly cold. Wearing a baseball cap is quite common for cross-country skiers to try to do that. And ended up getting a little frostbite in the ear. And the ear, as we know it, is a good prognostic sign of the blood, and there's not really much problem once you notice they're there. You just want to make sure you don't bust the blood and keep them fairly clean. It's some kind of antiseptic care. Because the blood do become ruptured, there's a high chance for infection. We know that the fluid from the lymphatic system and the lymphatic infection goes through the body very rapidly, probably more rapidly than one of the bloodstreams. Okay, the same causes of problem with the hand, we can take a look at this foot. If you can imagine the shape of a cowboy boot, these weren't cowboy boots, but they were rubber boots that were borrowed, you can see how that foot was wedged together. It really looked hard. Okay, there's a little point here that was wedged in, and these toes are all at an angle. They were wedged in to a boot that didn't fit them. Okay, a climber by the name of John Roskill in Spokane had a similar situation. He was on Deladari 2 or 3, whatever it was. He borrowed a pair of winter weight boots. He knew they were too short, but he didn't feel it would all get all that cold. And so the tips of his toes were wedged in a position where he got frostbite. It lacked the capability for circulation because of the constriction. Okay, now this is a kind of an ominous prognostic sign. This person rewarmed it and just right in front of a regular house fire. So there's no blood distally, on the digits, so that's not a very good sign. And in fact, he did lose a lot of tissue. And the rehabilitative process, when you lose tissue, it's just like a gunshot wound or any type of real bad cut, you tend to leak fluids for many years the rest of your life. Okay, this is a situation of minor frostbite that was rewarmed in front of a diesel engine. Okay, no real left. Wasn't really a bad case of frostbite, it was kind of minor. It would have been taken care of really easy. Those nails would come back and the foot will probably be a functional foot, but there'll be a little bit of damage there. Mm-hmm. Generally, the black type of stuff is dead tissue, and you don't need to amputate it. It just falls off by itself.
will actually form a line of demarcation, usually along the area of freezing, and then eventually it'll just drop right off. I'll point out at this time, the time I showed the movie, Judy remembers it, the climbers on Mount McKinley who froze their feet, thawed them out in each other's armpit, and refroze them along their toes in about 4 days. They just dropped right off. So what can you say about this particular slide?
Right.
Okay, his toes aren't looking good. This is right after the rewarming process. It's the burgundy color. That's what it looks like when you pull out. Usually you put it in there until it's flush. You don't want to cook it in your water because there's no reason to keep it too long. It's just until it's flush. Okay? So this is the burgundy color of the person just being rewarmed and pulled out. But what about the lower part? There's no blood there. Okay, so that's an ominous prognostic sign. It's not very good. And that's because the rewarming process in this particular case wasn't rapid rewarming.
Why was the cotton there?
You'll find out when you do get blisters like that, there's a certain amount of bruising that has to be controlled. You know, the cotton will do absorb that, but the skin will stick together. You know, so those bloods that do form, if there are any, will stick together. It's kind of like glue. You're going to have a real problem when these apart. So these places, it's quite common in burns to do the same thing.
I'm not a doctor on that, or a nurse, more qualified people,
but they're finding out now that a lot of these cure-all creams are just good catalysts for germs to grow in. This particular situation, automobile exhaust rewarming system probably would have saved it, you know, if it would have been rewarmed by a better method. It was either automobile or diesel. Either one of the temperatures upwards of 140 direct heat, just like rewarming in front of a fireplace. So, obviously, it's going to lose them. This is an automobile accident. You know, when you see the individual received the severe injuries, you know, it feels it's probably suspected fracture or something along the line. I didn't take the shot, it was given to me. But it wasn't an automobile accident on a highway where the cold, rescue came as fast as possible. The individual had received frostbite, rewarming in the ambulance, and on the way out. So, as I mentioned before, accident and the relationship to frostbite are very solid. We want to be very careful. Martin talked about food, but it's important that any food that has moisture in it, like cheese or meat or anything like that, is cut up prior to a trip and then placed in a bag because it's going to freeze solid. If you have to cut on it with a knife, you know, if you're not all that coordinated or familiar with working in a wet environment, you'll find out grabbing a metal knife in a cold environment is not a lot of fun. Okay? So it's better to cut it up small ahead of time and you won't have to worry about injuries. So this is a situation where you have in front of a very hot exhaust fan that is up in Alaska. This individual did a deep roll, he was wearing his low-quarter shoes, he wasn't injured, walked a half an hour to a kind of a pumping station where they had a huge jet diesel engine exhaust over 140 degrees. And he stood there in his low-quarter shoes and he won. And as you can see, it's still a functional foot. They have mobility. And you also notice here at this point, even though he used the wrong technique in a lot of cases, he didn't move any more than that tibial arch area. And because you know the capillary shunt, unless it's really a bad case, which are coming up, doesn't allow you to move any more than the toes. Super cool fuel dropped down on top of a loose pair of rubber boots. And the thing just went really fast. There wasn't anything a person could do about it. There was no way to rewarm it because looking at the shots shortly afterwards, you know, they figured the outside temperature was low at 20, minus 20 degrees. But the fuel had been sitting out overnight at a colder temperature, with a 55-gallon drum of fuel, the person was working with the spout, the top came off, and the whole lid popped off the top of it. It wasn't really designed for that purpose, and just went right down the boots, and it went down the But I'm saying the amputation was probably premature in the fact that it would have dropped off at a lower level and probably would have had more of a quicker work with. Okay, you can look again. Okay, so the treatment for frostbite is going to be wrap this down in warm water, and we're moving this figure to 104 to 110. There's a lot of controversy behind it. A lot of doctors are saying a lower temperature, some are saying a little warmer. And I think you probably go lower than 104, but you'll find out that the process will really be impaired when once you put in a cold extremity because it's going to drop the temperature of the water. But I wouldn't go much hotter just because you're finding out with a too rapid rewarming, you're getting a lot of blood into the area too fast for it to handle it. And we know since there's capillary shunting going on, you've got a lot of individual blood cells that are stacked up in those small capillaries. And those capillaries are only designed for one cell at a time, so it's a little bit slushy. So this warming system allows those things to thaw out in a very safe rate also.
If you get too much blood in there, like if you
heat
it up too fast.
It just seems like the cells thaw out too rapidly in light crystal film sometimes. From the blood. From the external heat, the cells thaw faster than the nitrogen. So you're facing two dilemmas. Either you thaw them out evenly and slowly, and both of them come out at the same rate, or one will puncture the other, or one will dehydrate without fluids and also die. So one of the contributing factors to have your windshield charged is wind. In many of the cases that I've seen related to frostbite, associated with wind. You can tell right away, people get blanched out rapidly when they're facing the wind. And this chart breaks down the danger of temperatures, and it shows little danger, increasing danger, and great danger. When you're talking about great danger, they really are. I mean, it's very several degrees in minutes, flush within an hour, depending upon your physiological shape of fatigue, exhaustion, fluids, food, and a couple other variables such as wind or smoke. Okay, so for a quick summary on frostbite, it's a very preventable problem. 80% of people with the feet, that kind of gives us an indicator where a priority is at. We're also aware that the hands and the neck part of the category and that adequate types of mittens rather than gloves are better because if you have the mittens on, you find out that all the fingers work towards the warming unit. You want to be able to know that. A lot of people wear gloves. You probably even to work in, but if you're doing backcountry travel, then you just carry along with the spear. You had to do something to use that spear. You're not worn as a primary item. Even if they're good ski gloves, you know, kind of an installation phenomenon about gloves versus mittens. Does anybody have any questions on frostbite?
Paul, I'm just a little bit confused. About when you should warm up people and when you shouldn't. Where the breaking point is.
I think that's probably an individual thing. I really can't tell you specifically when you should do it and when you shouldn't. I can say that if you do rewarm, you've got an evacuation case. Okay? And if you rewarm under field conditions, you're probably not going to be rewarming with water in a rapid rewarming system. You're probably going to be using external heat sources, which, as we've seen, are very detrimental. You lose tissue. I would say that most of the skiing that's done in this area here or any type of accident that might happen on the road, I would wait until I could get to the village to rewarm. Personally, I would do that. You go through a lot of stress because you know your feet's freezing, similar to that moving winter storm when the guy started running because you just knew it would creep up his body. It doesn't. It stops kind of at the toes unless, of course, you're dealing with pools. So
I would say, if there's any way to get back to really just your best bet, is rewarming by body heat, or fires, or diesel exhaust, really is detrimental to you. Either the cells start to rehydrate, the ice crystal is not ready to go, and it dies from the chemical imbalance and from the heat, or else if it's a blood expanding thing where the blood actually gets the ice crystals to melt first, the cells may not be ready. There's a lot of things that happen. And you can get the cells punctured by rubbing, and you can puncture by rewarming wrong. The best bet is to get back here, you know, and get rewarmed in this area. Now, if you're talking about other communities, you're going to have to make that decision. But the book that I have, which you can borrow for a reading source, is called Frostbite. It's by Bradley Morshorn. It's fairly old, but he's in here detailing the climbing and backcountry situations of trappers and people who have waited up to 4 days with frozen feet and came back out and thawed them with a rapid rewarming system, they didn't use their tissue. So I wouldn't think that any rescue around here would be more than a couple of days. I think you could probably, you know, based upon what I read in this book, you could probably wait and thaw it out here in the village.
What about rewarming when the person's in shock?
That's really tough. It's like that CPR in front of the avalanche question. The worst combination I think you could have is someone who was in an accident, who was in shock, who was hypothermic as well as frostbitten. The priority is going to be the frostbite. The shock is going to be taken care of by warmth and by administering whatever medical system you have. You know, I don't know if you have a G-suit up here or not. If you don't have a G-suit, all you can do is go for a warmth and just more tender loving care. You can't do a lot with shock. You know, let's face it, it's really a phenomenal thing. But the priority would be to the frostbite.
But
and rewarming that.
Okay, I think you mentioned that in shock the blood flow is restricted to the extremities. Is it bad to rewarm something when the blood is going to go through?
I don't know. That's a good question. I've seen that happen. People have rewarmed an individual in shock. There wasn't any blood supply there, like you mentioned. And it's like a flower over and withered. It doesn't turn out well. But to wait, the person's going to rewarm at room temperature, which is going to be just as bad. Just like accidents that happen in the Midwest, the person has frostbite because if they're related to a car accident, they put them in the ambulance, they have to rush them 20 miles to the hospital, the ambulance is on, you know, a fairly warm temperature, the person thaws out in the ambulance. And by the time they get there, they don't even recognize the person had frostbite, so they treat the injury, and then the frostbite shows up a day later. You know, it's really a severe problem. We're not trying to deal with this as a symposium where everybody that leaves here is going to go back to their own private practice and work with it. I can never answer those type of questions, but from the reading that I've done and the courses that I've attended to deal with it, it seems like the best measure that we know available is to use rapid rewarming, but this is going to be based upon, if there is a major problem, of going to the nurses and the doctors available individuals and let them make that decision. And that will be based upon a lot of trial and error guesstimation, because there's not that many situations that are as unique as Holden. And generally you have, like in Seattle, they have a heated oxygen system available with their mountain rescue, where even if you had a person in shock, you could administer that and rewarm them internally, and then rewarm them at the same time with your warm water immersion. But since you don't have a heated oxygen system, you just simply have to go with what you have available.
Same with field, if someone had an accident, went into shock, but also had a big frostbite, would you recommend like treating for the shock is getting them warm and elevated, and then maybe pack that foot into something just to keep it cold?
That would be a very heavy value judgment. I think I probably would if they were really in the shock.
But you would treat the shock because that is a life thing.
Right.
Whereas the frostbite,
right, it isn't, but what I was stating as far as treating frostbite, sometimes there's not a lot you can do for shock. Mm-hmm. You know, but let it run its course, keep the person warm, put them in shock position. And I think you might be able to rewarm frostbite while you're treating for shock. I think that would add to the heat in the body. That would be a heavy value check if you do that. But let's go back some. One of my, besides eating jumbo spiders, one of my fears, when I was skiing in Colorado, cross country skiing there, extremely tough. There's no flats where I was at. You traveled up those 1,900 feet in the morning and you came down. saw a lot of people hurt, and they would never remove their boots if the person had an accident. So from that, and I try to tell people that if you have an insulated boot on and the person's injured, you have to pull it off and put something on that's better, like a down particle. But they would evacuate people from this one area a lot, and they would never take off their contact boots. The people would get back in the frostbite toes. But if they could put a forward guard booty or put a parka wrapped around both feet, maybe even put someone, as they evacuate them out, have someone keep their stomach on the person's feet, they would have to be kicked off the frostbite. So I used to ski with a pair of insulated pants, similar to warm-ups, and I knew, I had little tags written out, please don't let me freeze my feet. I saw it so many times in this one area of Colorado where people just wouldn't understand that if someone's injured, boot no longer is with insulating mount. You have to get it off and get a better system on.
I've been in situations where if it is a suspected fracture in the leg or something, if you're not properly trained on how to remove a boot, there's so many legal lawsuits, hassles that come into because you could just have found the fracture.
Yeah, I'm sure. And in those areas,
that's probably going to be their basis for it.
But sometimes you just have to make some value judgments. That's what medicine is about in many cases for the unprofessional. The person who's not really trained in, even for the professionals, we see the number of suits they're having sometimes. Maybe what I'm saying is that if the person is injured, maybe it's not a fracture, maybe they're injured for some other reason. You want to make sure you pay attention to their feet, because being an extremity is going to be the last area to receive blood supply.